Well, hello, intrepid screenwriter, and welcome to this action-packed, content-stuffed, better than a Fantastic Four reboot video mini-course entitled 7 Secrets to Writing a Kick-Ass and Marketable Screenplay. Now, before we get started, I would like to answer that question nagging at the back of your head. No, it's not. Why did they make Transformers 3? No, it is, who the hell is this guy talking to me, and what qualifies him to talk about screenwriting? You know, aside from the fact that I own a director's cut edition of Ice Pirates on Blu-ray. Well, my name is Michael Rogan. I'm the editor and founder of Script Bully Magazine. I am also the author of a couple of moderately non-sucky books, including How to Write a Screenplay That Does Not Suck and Screenplay Format Made Stupidly Easy. And I'm also a former Hollywood screenplay reader, an optioned screenwriter. So I have detailed experience being exploited and criminally mistreated on both sides of the film business coin. But the real reason you should sort of listen to me is it is my absolute mission in life to share whatever screenwriting hacks I might have picked up along the way with talented, if slightly less experienced, screenwriters like yourself. If only so I get to watch better movies. So, without further ado, enough the preamble. Let's get started with secret number one to writing a kick-ass and marketable screenplay. Pick a screenplay structure lane and start writing. I know it is tempting to spend months, if not years, trying to find those 40 perfect story beats of awesomeness or that 7-act screenplay matrix of unstoppable destructionness that will help you unlock the secret cave where your story lives. And I know this because my bookshelves, which I can see right now behind the camera, my bookshelves are littered with thousands of dollars in screenwriting tomes and guides and manuals and hardcover books heavy enough to concuss a New York-sized rat. Yes, Robert McKee, that's your book. I did all this to find the structure and the paradigm that would give me access to that secret screenplay vault where classic stories live. But I can tell you from the heart, after years of reading a metric ton of mediocre scripts and writing even more metric tons of mediocre scripts, the best number one thing that you can do is A, pick some kind of story structure, even if it's as simple as a Kim Kardashian memoir. Nail down the bare minimum story that you need to know before getting started, and C, write the frickin' story. Trust me, you will learn more about structure and paradigms and your own particular storytelling rhythms by simply choosing something and seeing it all the way through. Then you will by spending months, if not years, searching for that elusive, perfect structure in the screenwriting jungle. And here's the big aha, if I can give it to you and save you 7 years. Screenplay structure is a device for you, the writer. It is not for the reader or the viewer. It's kind of like Dumbo's feather or a Hollywood actress and her Botox. It's a security blanket that gives them the confidence to reach their goal. It is not the goal itself. Now, you do need to pick some kind of structure for your screenplay. Otherwise, you'll be writing something aimless and incoherent or something you'd find at your local film festival. And if you've got your structure nailed down and you're all set, then go ahead, get started. But if you're still on the fence about which story paradigm is right for you, below this video, I've got a link to a resource I put together which might help. It's called the Script Bully Screenplay Structure Cheat Sheet, and it's kind of like a super quick down and dirty guide to the top seven story paradigms that are most used in Hollywood, and tips on figuring out which story paradigm is right for you and the story you're trying to tell. And also, you got some key takeaways from each of the story frameworks in there that you can use regardless of which structure you choose. Kind of like a screenplay structure greatest hits without the sucky B-side songs. So if you want more info on that, just click on the link below this video. But no matter what you do, choose something, because then you will be ready for secret number two to writing a kick-ass and marketable screenplay. Skip the nuance, go for irrational and obsessed. So there is a tendency, and I was guilty of this in my first, 1,200 scripts or so, and that is to write screenplays with protagonists that are complex, nuanced, empathetic, thoughtful, basically a hipper, better dressed version of me, the writer. To do this, to write these complex characters, it's totally great when you've got an agent repping you and you've got a 3-picture deal from Paramount. But until then, I would like you to make me a promise. Would you do that? Repeat after me. Okay, hold up your hand. I hereby swear to write a story about a main character who is obsessed, driven, irrational, and decisive. And I know that you can offer me tons of examples of movie characters from great movies that broke this rule. Protagonists who spend much of the story pondering and considering and reacting. Some of them are even classic movies, such as Tender Mercies or Being There or the first 45 minutes of Rocky. My favorite movie of all time, hands down number one favorite movie, The Third Man, features a mostly drunk Joseph Cotton character, and he spends like the first 67 minutes of the movie feeling sorry for himself, but he also spends most of the movie being overshadowed by Orson Welles, who's the most active, interesting character in the movie. But when you are just starting out, your job is to not only write a killer story, which is a given, but you want your characters to leap out of the swampy slush pile of unproduced screenplays, and you want them to grab the reader by the throat. And that is a hell of a lot easier when your main character spends most of their time slaying dragons, killing sharks, blowing up Death Stars, robbing banks, crashing Harvard Business School, and less time talking about slaying dragons, or deciding if they should blow up Death Stars, or debating whether they should go to Harvard Business School. And this doesn't mean your story needs to start off with your hero being chased in the Alps by ninjas on snowmobiles. The first 30 minutes of Jaws involve a very conservative and seemingly passive main character who is trying to remove the big bad shark without ruffling any feathers and pleasing everybody. But even in the midst of this, he is the whole time taking really small actions. He's closing the beach. He's making signs. He's bringing in experts, standing up to the coroner, reading big scary books about sharks. It is when he sees the big bad shark try to dine on his son that he takes the big Mongo action of chartering Quint's boat and taking the fight to the shark. But it's key you have your characters make decisions and then debate, not the other way around. This also doesn't mean that the course of action your hero takes has to be rational or healthy or even sane. In Dog Day Afternoon, the Al Pacino character is trying to rob a bank so that he can pay for his boyfriend's sex change operation. I mean, you want to talk about a goal that's a bit out there, but it is a great movie. If you haven't seen it, totally see it. Because in the movie, he is constantly doing things. He's bringing up Attica to distract the cops. He's trying to get pizza. He's trying to organize. He's doing all these little quick decisions and quick actions, and he's failing spectacularly. But when you have a character who's constantly making decisions towards something they want super, super badly, even if they have no idea exactly how they're going to get there, then you have something magical. You have a quest. You have a story, which means that you are ready for secret number 3 to writing a kick-ass and marketable screenplay. Think globally, write locally. So decorating your story world with characters and conflicts and locations and backstories and killer clowns is probably the most fun that you can have as a screenwriter. It's also where a lot of scripts lose their way in the screenplay weeds. And I continue to read scripts fairly decent in terms of characterization and conflict and dialogue. I mean, the writing chops are all there, but the world of the story is boring. Boring and generic and predictable and super cliche, and no director, except for that one who likes to make movies about robot cars, wants to be attached to something cliche. And I don't think it's because these writers are untalented or uncreative. It's because, in my opinion, creating a story world requires two seemingly contradictory skill sets. Number one, the ability to create an exotic locale that is visually interesting and at the same time imbue it with enough familiarity that it feels believable. It sounds simple, but it's kind of hard than it sounds. But if you're able to master this little screenwriting balancing act, your writing will literally leap off the page. So how do you do it? Well, it's something I like to call think globally and write locally. When you are imagining your story, when you're thinking up all those story world possibilities, it is in your absolute best interest to get as creative, wild, and Gary Busey on Red Bull crazy as you can. Let's say your story takes place in a law firm. Kind of boring, right? Well, what if the law firm was run by the mob or the devil or a corrupt military unit? Or what if your legal yarn is set in the Jim Crow Deep South, or the Holocaust tribunals after World War II, or the tumultuous reign of Henry VIII? These are extraordinary story worlds and story times, and not just because they let the wardrobe designer go way over budget. There's a real sense that the stakes and tension are at their absolute highest, right at that moment that things are at their absolute most combustible. So as you play with the raw materials of your story world, you want to go big and wide with the location possibilities. But once you do that, once you put your story stake in the ground, when it's time to actually write your pages out, you want to write locally. What the hell does that mean? Well, you want to keep your day-to-day writing as grounded in truth and realism as you can, even while the stakes and locations are like super otherworldly. Let's take Alien, for instance, the first one. This is about as exotic a story world as you can come up with. A faraway planet where creatures have acid for blood and like to dig tunnels through people's stomachs. Kinda wild. But the actual character interactions in that movie are pretty damn ordinary, at least for the first act. These are truck drivers. These are blue-collar space employees who are underpaid, overworked, totally exploited by the company they work for, and they have all the same gripes and resentments and office politics of any job. And this is what I think makes the movie so gripping and suspenseful. Not just aliens chasing after people. It has this real air and feel of real people. We can all relate to the feeling that our employers see us as replaceable meat. In this case, the characters literally become meat. And in the sequel, this sort of metaphor for corporate greed becomes even stronger. Let's take Avatar. Not my favorite movie of all time, but it's, you know, I don't know how much more freaking exotic you can get than the blue people of Pandora Island or whatever it's called. Except at its core, it's really a story of a guy who starts to question the programming he has built his entire life and identity around, or what we like to call high school. He starts to wonder if the enemy he is instructed to infiltrate and destroy is as primitive as he's been led to believe. And in fact, the real monster isn't the guys with the machine guns and the hover ships. This is what I think the writing gurus mean when they say, find you in the story. Not that you should write about what happens in your life. Sorry, but none of us live lives that are that interesting. But as you write your pages, you want to do your best to connect with these universal anxieties and desires that your characters feel in the midst of the scene. And the more normal and mundane you make them in this extraordinary, weird universe, the kind of cooler and weirder it gets. Tarantino is like an expert in that. Just make sure you place these real-life emotions that you're feeling in the shroud of a crazy, exotic location. Just don't do a planet full of blue people. That one has been already taken. Secret number four to writing a kick-ass and marketable screenplay. Let your subplots and villains do the heavy lifting. So you may not know this, but subplots and villains are a screenwriter's best friend. They're even better than that bootleg copy of Final Draft that you got from that hacker friend of yours. That's because subplots and villains can handle the most dangerous and flammable element of your script. Information, otherwise known as exposition. And there's a reason why Humphrey Bogart once said, if I gotta deliver exposition in a movie, there better be two camels fucking in the background. Audiences hate information. It's like homework or a season of One Tree Hill. It is boring. But here's the thing. Audiences need information. Otherwise, they're just consuming cinematic action with no context. There's no emotional connection, no turning points, no character identification, just crap blowing up. But what is a screenwriter to do? Use subplots and villains, of course. And here's how to do it. Number one piece of heavy lifting they can do. Subplots can reveal your theme. Subplots are a super ninja way of telling the audience what the central question or theme of your story is all about without having this obligatory scene that bludgeons the theme of your story over your audience's head like a Keeping Up with the Kardashians episode. In An Officer and a Gentleman, the theme is, are we just a victim of our upbringing, or can we become civilized, honorable, disciplined, and respected people despite our background, despite where we come from? And for the Richard Gere and Deborah Winger main romantic plot, the answer is yes, you can change. You can become a gentleman. You can outrun your slutty girl reputation and find true love with the sailor who's stationed there. For the other best friend couple, where things end really, really badly, the answer is no. No matter what you do, you're still low-class trash. And having these contradictory outcomes does not confuse your story. It actually heightens the power of your message, but only as long as you stick to one central question. You start riddling your story with more than one, and you'll end up with a muddled story. Or you've written a David Lynch film. Number two piece of heavy lifting that they can do. Villains can reveal backstory. This is probably my favorite. And by villain, I mean anybody who is the force of antagonism against your main character. But just so you know, backstory, you know, all that info that happened before we turn the camera on, might be the least interesting thing in the entire world, save for a Food Network marathon. And this is that kind of comic book super friends type sloppy way of getting info out, such as, But Captain Justice, this is the same cipher we came across in our mission to Milan back in 2003. You remember, don't you, when the fashionista assassins took me hostage and you had to break into the gelato factory and I fought off that one-armed man with the iron claw and the bad comb over. I mean, just saying that makes my brain hurt, but that's the problem. It's information. It's not dramatic. It just kind of lies there like a transformer fart. But if you give the backstory job to the villain or the antagonist and you make it a personal attack, you will have used some seriously cool screenwriting sleight of hand to get out your info. For example, you could have the villain say, "You mean the great and mighty Captain Justice didn't recognize the cipher from his mission in Milan? Well, that is sad. You probably even... Wait, you thought those fashionista assassins you fought in the gelato factory were trying to kill you? Ha ha! That must sting. To be wrong about so many things." Aside from my horrible accent, do you kind of see the difference? By the way, if you do end up writing a script about fashionista assassins in a gelato factory, please send it to me. I'm dying to read it. Okay, number three piece of heavy lifting that they can do. Subplot characters or supporting characters and villains can poke holes in your story logic. But why would we want to do that? Well, there may come a point in your story where you absolutely need this one thing to happen. Your hero needs to find the antidote just in time, or the romantic lead must somehow get to the airport at light speed and encounter no red lights and propose to his ex-girlfriend before she gets on the plane. And deep down, you know this plot device is so outlandish and unrealistic that you want to scrap the whole thing and throw your script in the dumpster before the Rotten Tomatoes message boards tear you a new one. And you could do that. Or you could have one of the characters in your story express the absolute ridiculousness of your plot device, such as, "I'm sure glad I always carry plutonium in my glove compartment, and I know this seems like a cheap tactic," and it is. But doing this will sort of dispel the nervous energy audiences get when you go a bit too far in the plot department. It's kind of like you're saying to the reader, "Look, we both know this is patently ridiculous, but I'm trying to entertain you here, so don't think about it too much. Just kind of enjoy the show." Now, this generally works best with comedies, action, horror, things that do not depend on realism. I wouldn't try this with Ordinary People or To Kill a Mockingbird. But if you've got some weird time travel paradox or a convenient way for your hero to get out of the lava pit or some last minute romantic comedy airport set piece that is so implausible that you know the audience will not buy it, don't stress so much about finding the perfect way to move that plot piano up the stairs. Instead, let your subplots and villains do it. Secret number five to writing a kick-ass and marketable screenplay: start on page 11. Just so you know what I'm about to talk about, this is entirely unavoidable at first. Your initial draft is gonna suck. It'll be clunky and overbearing and long-winded and aimless and a big bag of shite. And worst of all, you will feel the need to set everything up. This is what folks in the business call laying track, that part of your story where you introduce characters, set up relationships, establish conflicts. And this laying track is very helpful to you as a writer in figuring out your story, just as long as you cut it and never let the reader or audience see it. And one of the easiest ways to do this is to simply cut out the first 10 pages of your script. One producer I used to work with used to rip out the first 10 pages of every single script that was submitted to his production office. 10 pages every single time. His thesis being that every single writer seems to feel this need to do all this setup and establishment. And I don't know why. It's probably because the biggest insecurity we have as writers is that readers will not understand the story if we don't establish what's going on. But establishing is not storytelling. Just show characters in conflict going after stuff, and we will figure it out along the way. James Bond movies do this brilliantly. Sometimes, way back in the 80s, it was the only thing they did brilliantly. But for example, we fade in on a Russian military installation. Two British soldiers guard a small shed. An explosion ripples behind them. What's happening? At that moment, James Bond cruises by on a pair of skis, shooting a 50 caliber gun and holding a dry martini. Do we need to know what's in the shed, or why Bond is there, or the names of the Russian guards, or what they were doing 5 minutes ago? No, we will figure it out. We'll figure out that there's mean Russian guys who are guarding something super important and that James Bond wants to get to it. You can throw us in the middle of the action and we'll piece it together. Do you remember how Toy Story starts? Well, certainly that animated classic must have opened on a heartfelt scene with the boy Andy and his mom and somewhere in the house and nice music. No, it started with a felony. A row of moving boxes lie on the floor of the room. They're drawn up in crayon to look like a miniature Western town. A Mr. Potato Head doll is set in front of the poster. The voiceover of Andy, a six-year-old boy, can be heard acting out all the voices of the scene. Andy as Potato Head. All right, everyone, this is a stick-up. Don't anybody move. Now, empty that safe. When you finish your script, you do not need the first 10 pages. You might even want to cut all the way to page 15. I don't know. I could have gone to page 25 in most of my scripts, but you will be surprised how radically it improves the pace of your script, and it will also save on your copier bill. Secret number 6 to writing a kick-ass and marketable screenplay, and this is probably my favorite, take your climax and back it up 20 pages. So you've nailed down the amazing, no-holds-barred, everything-goes, ultimate climactic showdown of your script. You know, the part where the villain says, "You know, Jack, we're not so different, you and I." And you just know in your heart your climax is so powerful, it will shock every human on the face of the earth. It will cause women to throw themselves at you in uncontrollable screenwriting desire. It will force agents and producers to assault each other with handmade weapons to get you on the phone, which is great. I mean, powerful openings get scripts read, but it's powerful endings that actually get scripts sold. And with that, I would like you to take that awesome climax and move it back to the middle of Act 2, and then force yourself to create an even greater climax. What? I can't possibly do that. Well, this ninja tactic, some pretty killer things. Number one, it helps fill your crappy, boring Act 2. And most of us write crappy, boring Act 2s. Number two, it keeps the audience alert. They'll think, there's no way they can possibly go anywhere from there after that climax. Oh crap, they just did. And it forces you to top yourself, to come up with an even stronger, better ending, and that's never a bad thing. I know you do not think you can do this. You can do this. Trust me. All you're really doing is taking your Act 2 climax and moving it to the middle of Act 2, and then forcing yourself to up your game. The problem is most Act 2 midpoints are terminally weak, but if you shift the best stuff that you have to the middle of Act 2, and then you force yourself to come up with a new climax, then everything about your story will feel faster, it'll feel tighter, and way more entertaining, and you'll have a lot less plot that you have to come up with. You'll stop throwing like episodic little, well, I gotta fill in some pages here. And the cool thing is the reader slash viewer will have no idea where you're going. And that is screenplay gold. You would like an example. I think one of my favorites is Psycho. In the first half, we think we are following Janet Leigh in some hard-boiled film noir. But Hitchcock does an amazing thing. He literally switches genres in the middle of the film, going from thriller to horror in a single shower scene. And I will bet that a big part of the shock of that scene wasn't just the staccato jump cut murder of the hero, but the fact that audiences were like, oh crap, we're like 60 minutes in and this happened? I have no idea where this is going. We still got like 30 minutes left. I don't have a clue where we're going. So come up with the best, most awesome climax that's ever been created, then move it back and do it again. Secret number 7 to writing a kick-ass and marketable screenplay. Always be shipping. So there's this guy named Seth Godin. You may or may not have heard of him. He's a world-class blogger, author, public speaker, marketing expert who specializes in helping folks achieve habits and mindsets that help them get out of their own way and get some actual crap done. Not a bad thing to aspire to as a screenwriter, by the way. Anyway, there's a really awesome video, I'll share the link below, of a speech that he gave called Quieting the Lizard Brain. And the lizard brain, in case you're not up on your reptilian terminology, is the part of our brain that, as we sit down to write and we're ready to do it, the reptile brain says, are you sure you want to write today? You might suck, and people will find out how truly untalented you are. Wouldn't it be better if we didn't write today, if we didn't risk failure, and you and I just sat on the couch watching NCIS reruns while we eat salted caramel ice cream? Salted caramel. The lizard brain's job is to keep you warm and safe and free of stress. It also has a nasty side effect of robbing you of every ounce of joy, creativity, and passion that you can muster. But the trick, according to Godin, is to push through the lizard brain resistance and simply finish what you start. It doesn't matter if it's a short story, a Zen haiku, a screenplay outline, a script for a short film, your zombie trilogy. Always finish what you start. And finish does not mean perfect or good or coherent or anything that humans would like. It means you finish something. And if you're somehow able to push through the anguish and the frustration and the lack of creative ideas or the dearth of motivation you have about your current story, if you are able to push through all that and reach the last page, even if it totally sucks, then I promise you the universe will reward you. I don't know how. It could be with a brainstorm on how to fix that current story, or it could be with a kick-ass idea for your next script. Could be a boost of karmic awesomeness that helps you get your script read or possibly sold. There's this quote from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. My German isn't so good, but we'll give it a try. Let's see. Er will es dann nicht fallen lassen. Unwirket werte. Wille musch. What you can do or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. And I know this sounds like something you would see on Pinterest that your aunt had pinned, but I absolutely 100% believe it's true. For me, it was not until I stopped bouncing around like Tigger from like story idea to story idea, and I actually started finishing what I started, even when I knew it was the worst horrible story ever written, that I was able to find this story magic. And the cool thing about finding magic like that is it really does carry over into other parts of your life. It makes you feel like a contributing, creative, valuable member of society. It also happens to make you more confident, which makes you kind of more attractive to the opposite sex. But I know you're not as shallow as I am. So, but as we wrap up, I want to thank you so much for giving me your valuable time. And again, if you are still on the lookout for a story structure that suits your needs, I don't believe that there's one size fits all. I think, you know, the structure's got to match the story needs. Check out the link below this video to see, get more information about the Script Bully screenplay structure cheat sheet. Is that what it's called? Script Bully? That's a lot of S's. Hold on. Script Bully screenplay structure cheat sheet. That's too many S's, I just realized. Anyway, thank you again, and until we talk again, be bold, write often, and kick writer's block in the ass.